All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what the fucksters, what the fuck nuggets, what the fuck tuckians? Oh, man, I haven't used that one in a while. I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. I appreciate you being here. Welcome to the show. What's going on? I can't see right now. I'm wearing my glasses and I'm wearing my clip-on sunglasses because I just got my eyes dilated. I went to the eye doctor. I went to see my Jazzbo doctor, my Jazzbo optometrist, Dr. Elliot Kane. Yeah, man. Cool, man. Elliot Kane. Dude's a saxophone player, man. He's got a little trio going on. He's got a few albums. I've talked about him before, and he's probably in his 60s, but he talks all groovy and shit, and it's always good to see him. I was a little mellow, and he thought I was being... You know what? I'll tell you about in a minute. Today on the show, Kathy Griffin is here. I do want to make note and want you to make note, mental note, that this interview was recorded before Joan Rivers passed away. Otherwise, Kathy obviously would have spoken about it because she has spoken about it. But it's great talk. Kathy Griffin, I don't think you guys knew that I kind of started out with her. We go back a bit, not a lot, but a bit. We definitely went different directions, obviously. But we're all in show business. Isn't that true, people? Isn't it true? I'm going to be doing the Oddball Fest up at the Shoreline Amphitheater tomorrow night. That's in Mountain View, California. I'll be at the Verizon Amphitheater in Irvine on Saturday. I will be at the Tripany House. These are important dates. If you're in L.A. or you're traveling to L.A. and you want to come hang out with me, this is a cheap ticket. These are workshop shows. I'm trying to polish up a nice hour for next year's tour and for the New York Comedy Festival and maybe try some new stuff. But the Tripany House is a wonderful place to see me. It's a small theater. It's at the Steve Allen Theater, and they have a parking lot. So I can't pitch it enough. I'll be at the Los Angeles Podcast Festival on September 27th doing a live podcast. You can go to lapodfest.com or wtfpod.com for that information. And two big shows at the New York Comedy Festival on November 7th at the Skirball Center. If you have not gotten tickets for that, they added that second show and it's almost sold out. So don't wait any longer. Oh shit, Comics Come Home, November 8th in Boston, Massachusetts. That's a big show. Okay, so there you go. That's what I'm doing. Onward. It's cool, man. Dr. Elliot Kane, my jazz optometrist. Yeah, you know, he's doing a music thing and he's got his eye doctor practice going on. But I was feeling a little low when I went in there and I was feeling a little, yeah, it was like 3 p.m. I was tired and, you know, he's trying to get these things to, you know, the lens thing where he's switching back. Good. No. Yes. No. Yes. 1, 2, 2, 1. It's taking a long time and I'm starting to feel aggravated and anxious. And I'm like, what's going on, man? Why can't we nail this thing down? He's like, don't worry, man. It's cool. Take some time. I'm like, okay, all right. He says, how your eyes been? I said, well, you know, sometimes it seems like some days are better than others. Is that possible? Sometimes I have a hard time kind of focusing on far away things. Sometimes they seem good. Maybe it has something to do with me paying attention to it. But sometimes they're just not, you know, they're just, you know, this day to day, it seems. Some days are better than others. He said, yeah, man, that's the way it is with the mind, the soul, the eyes. And I'm like, yeah, man. I guess you're right. That is the way it is. So we went through all this stuff with my eyes and I'm like, what is going on? What is it? Is it that much worse? What's going on? He goes, well, you're getting old. You're getting older. My eyes are getting old. I do not like thinking about it. I'm not adverse to thinking about age, but I do not like to think about it necessarily. And I always wondered, you know, my mother always used to tell me, like, she would tell me, like, I don't feel my age. I don't feel old. I feel 20-something. And I'm like, all right, well, that's a little disconcerting. It's a little uncomfortable. But I guess I get what you mean. But I'm 50. I'm going to be 51 in a couple weeks. So I'm getting old. I get it. Every once in a while, I'll walk by the mirror and I'll be like, who is that guy? And for that split second, I saw me for exactly who I was with no filters. I'm okay with it. I still have a dream that someday I'll have six-pack abs, but they're unless they happen in a dream, I don't know how they're going to happen at this point. God damn it, I need to start running again. God damn it. I would almost thank whoever this guy is who decided to hand deliver a card to my home. I don't encourage it. It's sort of odd. He brought me, he got me a little card, but yeah, what did he say? Hello, dear Mark Maron, my name is so-and-so, Andy so-and-so. I am 19 years old, currently visiting Los Angeles, and I'm a big fan of yours, and I'm considering pursuing a comedic career and consider you one of my influences to do so. I've emailed the WTF podcast, but got no response. I was also told where you live at in Highland Park, but didn't want to simply knock on your door because I feared you would either call the police or think I was another one of the creepy fans you've been known to run into. I'm writing this not for an autograph or a picture or anything like that. I would simply just like to sit and talk with you, hopefully for a extended period of time. Also, since this may not be your address, although the WTF podcast bumper stickers on the car outside would suggest otherwise, I'm not too comfortable giving Al my phone number. He's got no problem walking onto my property and dropping me this card that says he wants to sit down for an hour, but you know, just in case someone else gets hold of this, he does not want to leave his phone number. He wants to make it clear to me. So please contact me on Twitter. And he gives me his Twitter handle there. Please respond as soon as possible. Thank you. Andy, I'm responding. Do you hear me, Andy? I'm not comfortable with this at all, Andy. I'm not comfortable with the fact that, you know, you just tracked me down. You got a nice card. All right, see, this is where it cuts both ways. I appreciate the sentiment. But you can't say you're not a creepy fan and then tell me that you want to just hang out for an hour, but you didn't want to knock on my door, but you had no problem putting, you know, coming up to my mailbox and looking at my car and shit. But the bottom line is, Andy, who did you think was going to get your phone number? That to me was the rub there. Like, I don't want to be weird, and this is weird. I just came to your house. I hand-delivered this. I looked in your car, and I told you I want to hang out with you for an hour, but I don't want to knock on your door. But just in case, I'm not going to leave you my phone number. Well, that's where you blew it, Andy, because I was going to call you. Good luck with the comedy thing. I generally don't know what you would do. I mean, I don't know what I would say to somebody trying to start out for 45 minutes. Anything that I mean, I say it all here anyways. You know, you just got to try it. All, you know, if you want to try comedy, that's all you can do is you can just, you know, go find an open mic, get on stage, put your three or four jokes together. You don't got to be up there 3 to 5 minutes. You can get off in 40 seconds if you want. No one's going to judge you. You know, that's what it's there for. Go try it. And if it sucks, don't do it again. But if it sucks, but you're hooked, God bless. Good luck. Godspeed. Welcome to the life. I believe I have said that before. So I didn't talk about Red Rocks. I did not talk about Red Rocks. I did the Oddball Fest last weekend. In Red Rocks at the, I guess you would call it the Red Rocks Amphitheater, but for those of you who don't know, it's just outside of Denver, and it is an amphitheater that was carved out of the rock right in the middle of the mountain. And it was spectacular. That was the reason I took that gig. I just wanted to play there. I wanted to feel Red Rocks. I mean, this place has been around since the early 1900s. It's been it's community oriented. When they're not doing rock concerts, they do movies during the summer. They do local events. It's a well used and well lived performance venue, if you could call it a venue. There's sort of like caves underneath it where you walk from one side of the stage to the other. It's all carved out of the mountain. People like Hendrix played there in like 68. The Beatles were there on their first US tour. The Dead was there. U2 filmed one video. I think it was Sunday Bloody Sunday maybe, but it's famous, man. Everyone has played there. Richard Pryor played there. I mean, the history of the place is phenomenal. There's a mystical vibe to being, you know, on the stage that's in this amphitheater carved out of the desert rocks. I don't know if they're desert up there, but they're red rocks. So they look like desert rocks. And it's just sort of on either side, there's sort of a stone-faced cliff almost. And there are those moments where, you know, you're thinking like, these rocks have bounced off some of the greatest sounds and feelings and notes in the world. They've absorbed it or moved it around. You know, that there was this moment when I was on stage thinking like, man, if these rocks, like if that one rock on stage left up there, that one ridge, you know, could talk to that other ridge. I wonder what kind of conversations they would have shared. You know, probably a few like, oh, no way. This is crazy. The rocks would have talked. I just pictured these two cliffs going, oh, fuck, yes. How is this even possible? Two big rocks, cliffs, just listening to Pryor. But at some point, one of the cliffs must have said to the other, what is this bullshit? John Tesh, why is this guy here? What's happening? Will they just book anybody at this place now? This is ridiculous. Hendrix was here. Pryor was here. The Beatles were here. The Dead was here several times. John Tesh, what's happening? And the other rock probably said, I don't know, man. Give him a chance. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of goofy. Look at that piano instrument. I've never seen anything like that before. You have seen too many shows. You've gone soft, Rock. And the other guy says, listen, don't talk to me like that, Rock. I enjoy some of this new agey type of noodling. Oh, you and I aren't speaking. So that's what I know. I know that both sides of the two sides of Red Rocks are probably not talking to each other right now. And it's over the John Tesh issue. That's my speculation. But the other interesting thing is that, you know, I was on that show with, it was me, CK, Aziz, Sarah, Whitney Cummings, Sarah Silverman, Whitney Cummings, Dimitri Martin, and Hannibal Buress, and me and Louie and Sarah and Dimitri a few years later, you know, we all started together in New York, and I hadn't seen Dimitri in a long time. And there have been times in my life where he's rubbed me the wrong way for reasons that were completely my own and projected. But he did a great set, and it was very sweet. And you know, it was interesting because we were backstage just watching, I think Sarah was on. Brody Stevens was there hosting. And Dimitri goes, it's just so wild, man, to see you out there and to know that when I was starting out, you know, I would go watch you at Luna, you know, just being, you know, who you are. And now we're here, you know, and you were just standing out there, just being who you are, you know, and this is like, what, 20 some odd years later. It's just, it's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing. And I'm like, yeah, it is, kind of. And, you know, and I really appreciated that he brought me down to that because, you know, you go through life and you're just sort of like doing it, next thing. And sometimes you don't take time, man. I got to take time to be like, holy shit, I'm living an amazing life and I'm grateful for that. I can do that, and I just did it right here publicly for you. Now, moving on. Enough of that emoting. I can make those feelings of gratitude into discomfort in a second. Just like that. That's the magic of me. I got a genuine, pleasant feeling. Why not just send that through the Marin Mill and turn it to garbage? Okay, as I said earlier, this conversation with Kathy Griffin was recorded before Joan Rivers passed away because Kathy certainly would have discussed that, but it was not a reality when we talked. And I hope you enjoy this. This is let's go now to me talking to Kathy Griffin, the amazing Kathy Griffin, the infamous and unique Kathy Griffin. Kathy, it's nice to see you.
It's fantastic to see you.
You know, my memories of you are old.
But I can't believe that you literally opened the door with our quote, tension. So obviously you want to go there and...
It's a bad memory.
Secrets. You're the one with secrets,
I have no
me.
Secrets.
Well, that's not what I heard.
What are you talking about?
I hear you're stockpiling secrets in a quest to get more famous.
No, I wish I could. I wish I had more. I dig them out of me.
I totally made that
You're
up.
The way famous one. But here's my memory.
Yeah.
That I know exactly when it happened.
Go ahead, because I do too.
You do? Aspen Comedy Festival?
Yes.
In a
hotel room, of course. It was you, me, Garofalo. I mean, we don't need to say the name of the lady, right? But there was a lady that you were seeing.
We were on a show, and you closed your set by ripping your shirt open, and I made some sort of comment. I said you're using your boobs as props. I think
was I even wearing a bra?
Yes.
Okay, because I'm more proud of the fact that I, at a later time, decided to do it.
Don't worry about it.
Is this for Patton Oswalt's pot?
Yeah.
But what happens?
It's for anyone's pot.
Honestly.
Go ahead. We're okay.
There was later a time when I felt I was so artsy that I was then doing it without a bra.
Uh-huh.
And I would do it to a Celine Dion song.
Right.
And
what was the point?
The bit was that Celine Dion took me to a place where I felt so free as a woman and an artist
yeah.
that I felt that clothing was no longer necessary okay. as a barrier between me and Celine. Uh-huh. And of course, it was yeah. the theme for Titanic. Now I would do something a little more modern. But I also got in trouble that night for taking all of my top off. I think I went down to underpants, but at least I wore
maybe
a bra that night.
That's right. Maybe yeah. that's right. But you were a different person then. This was before you were
it's all different.
A stunning princess of media. You were kind of nerdy. You wore glasses.
Yes. Which, by the way, which I still need.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like one of those assholes that like sort of hides them. And then when the movie starts, I put them on. But and then as I'm walking
that's
out.
That's not an asshole. That's an old lady.
Yeah, I'm an old lady now. And I'm so old that yeah. I actually lost my expensive
reading glasses?
The reading ones. Uh-huh. So now I just go to Duane Reade
sure.
and get the cheapies.
Just like every
but
mom.
The distance ones are Versace.
Okay, good.
Okay,
well,
just
as long
so
as you
know.
Got balance. All right, so take me back to the hotel room because it's starting to come back in flashes.
Was it the Diva in San Francisco, the Hotel Diva?
It was in Aspen.
Oh, Aspen. Okay.
Wasn't it where we had the argument? Was it there? Like you remember something heated? And now it's starting to come back to me. So Garofalo was there, Katsky was there, you were there,
right?
And it was a party.
God, none of these people are even talking to me anymore.
Really? Why?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, you're busy, or is it personal?
No, I think it's personal.
Really?
I think it's personal.
Did you alienate everyone but your gays?
I alienated everyone except my mother and the LGBTQIA2 community. And no, I just, I am honestly excited to see you because I have such a great nostalgic feeling about those times. And anybody from our, as we called ourselves the posse, which is very pretentious.
It was the generation. It was the first wave of alt comedy
yeah.
in Los Angeles. I was in New York, but you were here
but you
with
were
Lapidus.
In,
yeah,
right,
no,
you were in the group.
Yeah.
Whenever you came to town,
right.
you were doing a set.
That's right.
And
wait, let's figure out what okay. the tension. What was the argument about?
I think you were having an affair with Tracy. And then I think you slept with a different girl and I found out.
Yeah.
And I think I'd like to take the credit myself, but I think I may have included a couple of the other gals from our group
uh-huh.
and busted you out and like called you out on it at some party. And then you were like, who are you to call me out on it?
Right.
And I was saying, Tracy's my friend. And I'm laughing because like I said, I don't think any of those girls even talk to me anymore. So once again, I have a very long history of sticking up for people who then really couldn't give two shits about me.
I remember.
But
I think I know what it was. I think it was because, you know, before I was with somebody else when Tracy and I had a fling.
That's right.
And I think that, you know, that it came up because we were all, yeah, okay.
But I just want
no
to
secrets.
Say this, though. No like, secrets,
I thought
also,
it was about material.
Material? Oh, maybe.
I thought it was me judging you in some harsh way.
Oh, God. I was so used to you and Louis and David Tell being so mean to me. You guys were all so vicious.
Were we?
Oh, my God. And, you know, I remember I was bombing every single set, and
right.
you guys were crushing every set.
I think that's what it was. Yeah. What the fuck is she doing?
Right. So for me to be part of a lineup with, let's go over it. Like a typical lineup in Aspen would be like Louis C.K., David Tell, you.
Yeah.
Who else
in the
would
90s.
Crush? DePaulo.
Yeah.
Like DePaulo would
yeah.
crush. Adam Ferraro would crush.
Right.
Like these were guys that were like, boom, getting big laughs, walking off stage, and then getting freaking deals.
Right.
Like, or meetings with networks. And then I go up there with my little stories.
But
here's
you were
my story. I'm a raconteur. And then and bombing so badly that I remember one time Nick DePaulo was mad.
Yeah.
He had to follow me.
Because
as I walked off, all you could hear was the clump of my Doc Martens.
Yeah.
And you always get at least a thank you, goodnight applause.
Right.
I was bombing like so badly that people were just conversing. Like, I will say I was lucky enough not to have hecklers.
Right.
But people would just check out. And so I was like, thank you, Aspen. And you just hear the Doc Martens clump
off
stage.
It was a hard situation.
And no, you guys killed it.
I don't
you
know.
Owned
it. They did. I don't know. I think I was in between
Norm
you and
McDonald
them.
Norm McDonald would like destroy their.
But you were choosing to do something you knew was tricky.
I knew how to do.
Right. But you weren't. I don't know that you were even considering yourself a stand-up comedian at that point in
well,
a way.
I felt I was, but remember, my background was Groundlings, and I went about it, as my mother would say, ass backwards. I really did start out as an actress.
When did you come out here? I mean, first of all, let's
I never
get,
did stand
I don't
up.
Know anything about you.
Okay.
I mean, I know the
oh,
world
I think you
does.
Do. I think you do.
I know some things.
All right. You know things that other people don't know.
I remember you around. You had an edge to you. You were kind of, I remember you as being sort of angry.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like being around you. I always felt that we were about to fight.
Yeah.
But I think that was the way you were.
Well, look, I'm going to be honest. I really resented you guys because I felt like, and I kind of think this is still true. I felt like the guy, this is a good thing. I felt like the guy comics, you and your crew, were very good at like sticking together and having each other's back and supporting each other. And one of the reasons, honestly, that I am sort of associated with the gay community is it's one thing I admire about the gay community as well. I feel that they get together, they actually make progress. And I feel that, unfortunately, as a militant feminist, my issue with women is often we tend to be the cliche and we tend to let ourselves get divided and conquered.
Yeah.
And one thing about your group, whether I felt you guys were being nice to me or not, is I really would watch from a distance and go, God, every set they support each other. Every set they're giving each other crap and they're joking around. And I felt like with the girls, and there were so few of us, I felt like Sarah Silverman was very much in your club.
Right.
She grew up with us. And yeah, she grew up with you and she's gorgeous and I wanted to be her.
Yeah.
And Janine was very much in your club because she was, you know, Reality Bites and she was edgy.
But we grew up with her too.
Right.
It was a weird
thing. And everybody was talking about her. And I didn't quite know where I fit in. So I thought, well, maybe if I just keep hanging out with them, they'll like me, but I never could get that style of like crusher club comedy that
jokes.
You guys had.
You were not a comedy club person.
Correct.
But you came up, when did you come to LA first?
I came to LA in like 78.
Oh my God, from where?
From Illinois.
You grew up in what, Chicago?
I grew up in Forest Park, Oak Park, never Chicago proper, but I grew up grade school, Catholic school in Forest Park. I've left the church, just in case you're
I was assuming.
Wondering.
Yeah.
I've left in a big way.
But you grew up in a real Catholic family?
Yeah, real Catholic.
How many kids?
Youngest of five, total Irish alcoholic, full story.
Both your parents or just your dad?
Both.
Both alcoholics.
And, yes. And
from Ireland.
And then the one priest who was an uncle that kept getting moved parish to parish.
One of those.
Yeah.
Still alive?
No, he passed away of AIDS.
Was there, really?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Right.
That's so you've got the history of church in your blood.
Yes.
Got the history of the Catholic Church.
I remember Father Porter.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you ever did the Boston Circuit, remember that big story?
Sure.
And that started from the old timey personals. Someone wrote in and wrote, do you remember Father Porter? And then that was, I don't want to say the start of it, but I mean, that was sort of a very public way to.
What was that other one from Boston? Shandley? What was his name?
Every archdiocese has one. And, you know, a lot of my comedy, I mean, a lot of why I've become sort of like the big mouth or the whistleblower or the behind the scenes about pop culture and celebrity is, you know, when you grew up in that Catholic family of don't say anything,
lies.
And even if you see proof of it, you better deny it because that's how we roll. That's really what made me the mouth in the alcoholic family.
Well, how did you end up not being alcoholic? Did you go the other way?
Never had a drink in my life.
Are you control freaky?
Yeah.
Oh, so you went that way?
Yeah.
Trying to manage.
Never had a drink in my life.
Are your parents, were they actually Irish? Did they?
100%.
Really?
With
accents and everything?
No, they actually, my mom is the youngest of 16.
Oh my God. How is that even possible?
Take it in. Because imagine her mom.
Every year?
Every 9 months, probably. Because that was birth control. Birth control is for the devil, remember?
Right. No, I understand it, but that sounds ambitious. 16.
I don't think there was a lot of thought put into it.
No, I know that, but I've never heard of a family
so
of 16
kids. Do you know what steerage is?
Steerage underneath. Yeah, sure.
So they came over steerage, and then
all 16 of them.
No,
how many fucking cousins do you have?
Innumerable. and it's funny because some of them I get along with really well, and then some of them, I don't know if you found this like in your family, but when I grew up, the times were so much more liberal that I have cousins where when we were little girls, we were talking about the National Organization of Women, and we thought Gloria Steinem was like the coolest chick ever.
Yeah, we grew up in the
70s. And that same cousin is now like going on the Glenn Beck Israel tour. And is like super, super religious.
How are you going to find that? How do you know when someone's going to, you know, snap back? Do you know what I mean?
In which way?
Well, I mean, you know, you grow up in the 70s, and I think a lot of times when there's no boundaries or there people have a difficult time, sort of processing everything, they snap back, they close up, and they look for something that can, you know, that is narrow and has order, and usually it's wrong.
The reason I'm looking at you quizzically is because that almost didn't exist, or rather the process of seeing them snap back didn't exist.
Right.
And so I really felt it was it was, I don't want to say incumbent upon me, but I felt like I did not have a choice as to be that sort of alien, the movie Alien.
Right.
Trying to relate to the heteros.
Sure.
Bursting out of me with, if nothing else, honesty. And I think many of the reasons I bombed for like a good, I'm going to go with 5 years solid, is because I just sort of stood there saying sort of things that were honest and hoping some of them were funny.
Well, I think that one of the, I think the one thing that you might have lacked was a certain, you know, stand-up stagecraft. Like the audience,
I had none.
But the audience was different. See, like now you find your own audience and they're completely capable of listening. But I do not think that audiences who were expecting a stand-up show had anywhere to place you in their mind.
Well, you have to know that I, to this day, I really get the ass crack sweat thinking about doing a 7-minute set or a 10-minute set.
It's impossible for long-form people to do that.
Oh,
it's hard for me to do it.
But do you remember the days, and I don't know if you might have been too cool for this, but like, do you remember the expressions of like trying to get together your Star Search 3?
I never tried to do Star Search.
Okay, so in our crowd, whether you like it or not, there were several people that either were on Star Search or trying to get on Star Search, and I couldn't believe, I was dazzled by the ability of any comic to do, and I think Todd Glass may have been one of them, by the way, and many, many funny comedians that could do a set in 3 minutes.
It's impossible. Well, now Letterman's, he's still 4.5 minutes. I mean, Tonight Show 6.
That's
still
right. There was the Tonight Show 6.
Yeah.
Then there was, I think it would jump to like the College 50.
Well, yeah, I had to do an hour, yes.
Now, did you used to go to that college convention?
No, NACA. I was...
You? What? That's like made for you.
No. Back then, I was an angry, insecure guy. I was not operating...
Like every college kid, you mean?
Well, right. But I was not operating at the same level, the same popularity as even Dave Attell or Louis or any of those guys.
Really?
Yeah. No. I was sort of an outsider.
Because I could never get invited to NACA. But like, I remember Garofalo would go and she would sort of brag about bombing. And yet it led to, I think, lucrative gigs for a lot of our friends.
Oh, yeah. The guys who could do it. Yeah, I mean, you're usually playing for freshmen. It's usually student activities money. I never did that well.
Okay, I would think you would do very well.
As a professor.
So do you feel like, because I just did a college last weekend. Do you feel like when you and...
How'd you draw?
I drew okay, but I will say the audience was shockingly good, and I did the basketball court. So, you know, sometimes you do a college and you do the like performing art. Like I did a show at Harvard that was like a dream.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you're back in the basketball court, baby. And they were so nice.
Yeah.
But I would think you do very well at colleges.
I haven't tried. I will try.
They're fun.
I know. It's time. I can go as me now.
You go as a celebrity. And then they buy tickets to see only you.
Yeah. No,
to see a show.
Right. I'm doing okay with a draw in some places.
No, you're doing great.
And I think that it'll be good. But I'm curious now. All right. So you have your four siblings.
You want to just talk ticket sales?
No, I'm not going to.
I'll four wall with you.
No,
up at the ass, honey.
You're
I'll
a rock
wall,
star.
I'll four wall. Whatever you want to talk about.
You are an empire.
I've gone from the guarantee to the back end. I've gone to with counting with like Joey Left Eye in the back until the show's over. Yeah,
sure. So, all right, but I'm more curious about what made you who you are.
Okay.
So you have four siblings.
Yes, youngest of four.
Are they around?
No, my eldest brother Kenny. He was a crack addict and homeless.
For how long? I mean,
a long time. And what's odd?
How much older is he than you?
Well, here's what's so delicious and twisted about my family. My beloved mother, who's going to be 94 June 10th, and does enjoy a box of wine, and yet is highly functional.
Yeah.
In fact, is shockingly sharp as a tack.
Okay.
So my joke is, I'm like hoping she gets dementia.
Yeah.
So she just remembers everything and still like gives me shit about the same stuff. But anyway, she lives nearby and then she stays with me sometimes. My father passed away 7 years ago. Here's what's tricky. I don't know if you have this in your family. I didn't realize till my father passed away that my mom was always like the potential right wing nut job, and my dad luckily was lefty and kept the balance.
Right.
So now I've kind of like, I don't want to say lost my mom to Bill O'Reilly and Hannity and those nut jobs, but our arguments are getting more heated than I would like.
Well, O'Reilly kind of plays a Catholic card too a little
bit. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So he taps in, yeah.
He taps into Maggie Griffin in a big way. And of the siblings, what was interesting about my brother Kenny was that while he was never convicted of being a pedophile, he also didn't deny it. So I grew up with that kind of energy and that kind of Catholic stuff happening and the secrecy around it.
Well, do you think he was abused?
Yes. He allegedly told my parents, not in front of me, that it was in fact like a coach that had abused him. And I'm assuming, I'm going to go with priest while we're at it.
Uh-huh.
And I have another brother.
But did he abuse you?
No, but he had a friend who did. Not, I, you know, this is very odd in this sort of world that we're talking about. I want to be sensitive. Abused, but not, this is going to sound so weird. I'm so afraid to like downplay anything, but not penetration,
right.
But still abuse.
Right.
It was not good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, my theory is that because this guy was my brother's bestie,
mm-hmm.
I have often had a lot of fear and guilt about, is this something that they were doing together for fun? Because
right.
My guess is dudes like this find each other.
Right.
And also in my brother Ken's case, who's no longer with us, his ex-wife and then separately his ex-girlfriend told me personally that he was doing this. And when my father finally said to him later in life,
yeah.
Kathleen is estranged from you because she believes you're a pedophile. Is uh-huh. that true? And my brother Ken said to my father, I do what I do.
That's what he said.
Okay. So to this day, my beloved mother is like, well, that's not an admission. Let me tell you something. Do you have sex with kids?
No.
Okay. So your answer isn't I do what I do. Okay?
Yeah.
If you asked me, I would not say I do what I do. I would say, nope, I sure don't.
Yeah, no way.
And I can probably prove it.
Right.
You know.
Did your parents, either of them, sober up?
Well, I will say that here's what's interesting. They were always highly, highly functional. They never got into a car accident.
No violence in the house?
No violence in the house.
Yelling.
Except for my brother. The brother who passed away
Kenny.
Was violent toward his wife. In front of me.
But he seemed traumatic. Like he got the disease.
He was
got
off the rails.
Alcoholic
he was off the rails.
And, yeah, always.
Always, yeah. But no, what's interesting about my mom and dad and so a couple of my siblings is never got DUIs, but I could like make a Tom Collins when I was 8.
Right.
So if you think that's normal to have mommy and daddy say...
Well, you're the one who was in control of everything.
Well, we had the paper, like
sure,
the packets.
Sure, the Tom Collins.
But you know,
yeah,
I mean, did you grow up on like Space Food Sticks and Tang?
Not really. I grew up a Jew, so there was more...
With real food?
Yeah, not really real food, but more diety food. I think I grew
okay.
up with.
Because my mother, I'm just going to tell you something, and you can judge as you will, but I'm going to just tell you what my mother
I'm
said.
On board with you.
I'm just going to be honest because,
yeah,
all right.
We're doing honest.
A, she's 94, so I'm going to give you a little bit of the
she's
codependent.
She's not going to hear this.
No, what I mean is I'm sort of afraid you're going to turn on her, but I'm just going to tell you
I'm
this.
Not going to.
Okay. And like I said, I'm making excuses because of her age, but it's inappropriate. So I moved her into this gorgeous retirement village that mm-hmm. has everything. It's like the Four Seasons. It's mm-hmm. beautiful. Her one complaint about it is that it is, these are her words, too Jewy.
Yeah. No, I can understand that.
But can I tell you why she feels it's, quote, too Jewy?
They talk too much around her?
No.
What?
They're way more concerned with the food than the booze. Don't laugh at that. Don't support that. Please. Please. You should be condemning her and saying that that's horrible.
Yeah.
So when when she said that to me, I was really, that really caught me off guard because I've never
Doesn't
heard.
Doesn't surprise me.
No, but I've never heard anything anti-Semitic from her in 94 years. And I finally was determined to get to the bottom of what is too Jewy in your mind? And then when she said, how, you know, there's like a cafeteria at the retirement
yeah,
village.
Right.
She said, how many times when I'm trying to have a glass of goddamn wine can those people return a tuna melt?
she just wants to be left alone to drink.
Yes. So my question for you is she an anti-Semite or not?
No, I think she's seeing Jews in their rawest and most irritating form. I think... After a certain age, it's just about food and poop, and it can't be a party for anybody.
Well, don't get me started on the shits.
Yeah,
because that is her main topic.
Sure, sure. But her is booze and shits. That's a difference.
Well, she doesn't understand why an entire tribe would choose food when there's wine and
the different priorities.
There's a Manhattan to be made.
Well,
there's an old fashioned to be made.
Well, I think the Jews by nature eat their feelings away, and the Catholics by nature drink their feelings
Hello,
away.
Speak English, please.
Sure.
That does not compute with Maggie Griffin.
No.
One iota.
Food doesn't. Food is not capable of suppressing the secrets
of
your
mother. But you're okay with her using those people?
No, I'm not okay with it, but
those
I mean...
Those people
after
would
a
rather
point,
have a nice sandwich?
What do you want me to say? Your mother's a horrible Jew-hating old Catholic lady?
Well, I can't say it.
No, I'll say it for you. From my point of view, your mother's a horrible Jew-hater.
Oh, my God. The bad thing is my siblings will listen to this. So my mom won't, but my siblings will.
No, I mean, you know, people...
But it's sort of... You got to laugh.
People of certain dispositions, you know, who have a legacy or an honor, who honor their past, and they come from a weird place. Jewish bigots are no better.
What is your cutoff age?
For what?
You know what. Like, at what age will you kind of let a comment like that slide?
It's at the age where you know the argument is not going to change anything. You're not going to shed new light.
So would you, okay, 45 or 50, would you be like, dude, you know what?
That's a little inappropriate.
And then, like, is there a specific cutoff point where you go, you know what? I'm just going to let this one pass.
Well, sometimes it just depends. Do you want to invest the energy in how horrible is the comment?
And sometimes you feel guilty investing the energy. Well, yeah, sometimes someone at a certain age where you think, well they could die.
Well, the ones that I don't like are the ones that test you. Like, they say something, they're like, well, you're going to let me.
Oh,
you
know, that's
like,
all old people. That's every person at my mom's retirement.
Some people
village.
Are just shameless about
they
it.
They love to push the button. That's their way of like feeling young again and stuff. My mom's a big button pusher. That's why I joke that, you know, the dementia's got to hit eventually because
maybe
she
not.
Can get the jabs
not,
in.
94, it hasn't happened. It's not
her idea of a good time.
Where are the rest of your siblings? Are they all okay?
My brother just passed away a couple of months ago from a very, very nasty battle with esophageal cancer.
Oh, my God.
And I will tell you this, if I can get serious for 1 second.
Get serious.
One thing, I was in the room with him the whole the whole nine, yeah.
You were that close.
Well, the palliative care people are amazing, and they actually come out and go, do you want to be in the room? And if so, this is probably how it's going to go.
So your family was there. Everybody was there.
It was really cool. My brother and sister were there, and they both said, we'll be in the room. And then I said, hey, just so you know, like, no judgment. Whoever wants to be in the room, we can never bring this up later at a drunken family Christmas.
Like, why weren't you in the room?
Right. And so my mom said, I can't handle it. And then she did something very sweet. She asked if my boyfriend would sit with her.
Uh-huh.
And the comedy, because you got to find the comedy and everything,
sure.
is that my boyfriend had, about 5 hours earlier, had his first colonoscopy.
I just did that.
But you're supposed to take the day off when you have a colonoscopy.
Yeah, you should.
No, he was actually up and running with the Griffins, the crazy Griffins.
I think the 2 days before is when you should probably stay close to home.
Yeah, that's not fun. That's not fun. But I'm just saying, a colonoscopy is no joke with the, you know the hospital, they call the propofol Michael's milk.
Uh-huh.
That's like hospital humor.
What does that mean?
It means that's how Michael Jackson died, from a propofol overdose.
Right.
So the nurses love to be like, you want some Michael's milk?
Uh-huh. You don't even feel it, though. I went right out. I don't think I got that.
Did it even make you try to count back?
They made me try to count back for three seconds, and then I was out.
I was
going to
say, because when they say from 100, I always feel like saying, you know, you can start at 3.
Yeah, just
you
do
3. You don't need to say count back
even,
for 100 anymore.
I don't even remember. I just remember talking to the doctor, and I didn't even see the anesthesiologist. I think he just started.
Like
the doctor said, yeah, turn on your side.
Did you express fear? Like, did you say, like, I'm an anxious person?
No, I didn't. I was pretty in. I was a little weird. The facility was a little odd to me because it wasn't a hospital.
It's just a room.
Well, it's like an operating facility. I didn't realize I had those where, you know, that's all they do there is doctors kind of rent the place.
Oh, I know that from plastic surgery.
Right.
So, one of those places. So when I had my facelift in 2001, I was like, this is somebody's office.
Yeah.
And then the scam is this is plastic surgery, which I know you're very into. Obviously, you clearly have had a ton of work done.
I have it in my family.
The scam with plastic surgery is that if you go in for a facelift, number one, they do it in an office, not on like this. And number two, they have the nerve to charge you rent.
Right.
It's their own office. And then they go, okay, so the facelift is whatever it is. And then there's the facility rental fee. And
yeah,
I'm like,
I had to
dude,
pay that too.
That's your office.
Is it their office, though?
Yes.
Or is it,
it's a scam.
Well, that's a bit of a racket.
Well, this was plastic surgery.
Let's go back, because I have a specific thing I want to know.
Okay.
So you leave your massive Irish family.
Yeah.
You turn your back on God. At what point?
I turned my back on God in junior high. I came home and announced when I went to St. Bernardine's that I wanted to become a Unitarian. Because I had heard that they were, you know, not as strict, et cetera. And then my father, this is sort of funny. My father threatened to disown me in, I think, 7th grade. And I was like, where am I going to go? Like, what does that really mean? You're going to, and you know, I was trying to be existential.
Yeah.
And then he did scare me, I think, into going to mass a couple more times, but.
But you went to confession and everything.
Oh, I did the confession. I just want to say, in defense of Unitarianism, the Unitarian Church in my town of Oak Park was built by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Pretty.
So I just want to say, I'm not a religious person, but if you're going to go to one service, go to Oak Park, Illinois, and go to the Frank Lloyd Wright Unitarian Church, because it's beautiful.
How did the whole Catholicism thing fuck your head about sex in general?
Well, first of all, you know, I for whatever reason, at a very early age, just like my act, the one thing I can't stand is not talking about things.
Right.
And so, you know, I remember I had a very progressive, do you know what a lay teacher is?
A lay teacher?
Yeah. In the Catholic Church, you're either
not of the cloth.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. So when I was, I actually just had dinner with my third grade science teacher after a gig I did over the weekend, Mr. Major. Mm-hmm. And he was a lay teacher, which was like very edgy, right?
Right.
When one of our modern-esque lay teachers, mm-hmm. very living on the edge, and I'm sure without any approval from the nuns or the priests, gave us a simple worksheet that you should give to anyone, certainly in junior high, which would be seventh or eighth grade. And it was a worksheet that you do with your mom and dad.
Yeah.
And it was basically birds and bees.
Right.
So I was very excited to like have an actual conversation. I knew not to go to my dad. I was right. like, forget it. He's working 12 hours a day at the hi-fi store.
That's what he did?
Hi-fi.
Yeah. Sold stereos?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
I wanted to test you because I wanted to see if I hear one person say what's hi-fi, I'm going to smack him.
No, I always went to hi-fi stores.
Thank you.
Did he have his own hi-fi store?
Okay, this is the one area that we were cool. So total middle class all the way, total depression parents.
Yeah.
Because my dad worked at a hi-fi store, each one of us five kids had our own stereo.
Nice.
That's pretty cool.
And you had older sibs, so you had a lot of music coming at you.
I was all about their older music. So I was all about getting, you know.
It sounded like you had every decade represented. Because you. Well, what was the difference between you and your brother age-wise?
20 years.
Oh, so yeah.
So that's the thing is I actually did grow up on really good music. So it was all like, you know, Beatles and Bonnie Raitt and all that stuff. So anyway, there was a worksheet where I was supposed to have an open conversation with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from a Catholic school, so it didn't have like bad words.
Yeah.
And I remember my mom was on the phone with my Aunt Irene, and it was like the long cord phone.
Yeah.
And she was sitting on a stool in the kitchen. And I just, when my mom talked to my sister, it was kind of sacred.
Yeah.
So I was even afraid to tap her shoulder. And she was in the moo-moo, the whole thing. And I said, Mom, this is part of an assignment. I have to ask you these questions. She looked at the paper from St. Bernardine's and went, Jesus Christ! I'm not talking to you about this. You know what? And I said, but Mom, we're supposed to talk about something called contraception.
Yeah,
and my mom said, the word no. Now I'm talking to your aunt. And that was my birds and bees talk. The word no, I'm talking to your aunt.
Well, were you afraid of hell?
Yes. And that was even in third grade, I had the hand up and I was like, Sister Mary Betrayal. Okay, that's the flying nun. But Sister Mary, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I would say, these seem like kind of minor infractions.
Yeah.
Like, I get the hell, you know, killing someone.
Mm-hmm.
But really, using the Lord's name in vain? Have you been to my house?
Yeah, right.
Everybody's going.
So it seemed unreasonable.
Well, and also.
It seemed like a racket.
Not only that, also, concurrently, while I was hearing that from the nuns at school, the minute I went home, I would hear a litany of reasons I was going to hell in a handbasket.
Sure. And that seems small.
Okay, but I don't know what a handbasket is.
Anyway, so I see you can't fit in it.
Okay, thank you. So I didn't know how seriously I was to take the nuns when I would go home and my mother would say, you're going to hell in a handbasket.
So you eventually thought it was a scam.
Very early on. Yeah. I'm gonna go ahead and say maybe even first grade.
Yeah,
like early on, I was going, this sounds like bullshit.
Right. So now the decision to, well, when did you end up losing your virginity?
Oh, that's the part I'm the most proud of. 19.
Oh, good. Yeah. You waited.
You're not shocked by that?
No.
What about you?
17.
Nice job. Because everybody else who says 13, like it's nothing, I can't even imagine.
I
had
a lot of
sex.
Anxiety about it.
No, I...
Not even God related, just generally. I saw porn too young and it really fucked my head up.
Okay, so I never saw porn, but up until 17, did the idea of sex actually turn you on or was
absolutely.
It weird?
Absolutely, but I just, the idea of like, you know, getting from it turning me on to
doing it
was a big leap.
See, when for me, like really up until, like I said, 18 or 19 when I finally did it, the idea of it sounded potentially painful, bizarre, I know as a dude, you're going to laugh at this. It took me a while to go, I'm not sure what the girl gets out of it.
Yeah.
Because growing up without ever
I don't know, early on, I don't know if they get much out of it.
I never masturbated until after I started having sex.
What were you doing?
Not masturbating. So when it came to, should you have sex at 14, 15, 16, 17?
Why didn't you masturbate?
I didn't even know what it was. It didn't even occur to me. I thought it was something boys did.
Really?
Really?
So
there was no porn in my house, zero.
But there were brothers, and there was some sexual deviancy.
Correct. But I never walked in on any of my brothers masturbating.
Huh.
I certainly, you know, I never walked in on mom and dad having sex, so I don't have that story.
But did you do any? Did you do everything else before you lost your virginity? I mean, were you doing other things?
I don't think, okay, here's what I can, I swear to God, I did not talk to one of my grade school or high school girlfriends about masturbating. My hand to God, I did not like even say like, have you guys tried masturbating? My first boyfriend was like, what do you mean you've never masturbated?
Yeah.
And then I said, well, I mean, I guess I should, or I wouldn't even really know how.
This is when you were 19.
Yeah, when I was 19. And so the first guy that I had sex with kind of like walked me through it and showed me. And then, of course, I was like, oh, this is great. But
I don't need you anymore.
This guy was very, he was.
Thank you. Goodbye.
I felt bad for this guy. Like, I was such a horrible first lay for this guy.
Yeah.
Like, this guy had sort of, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he's like patiently going, well, here's how you masturbate and here's how you fuck. And
yeah.
I was like, really? You know, yeah. I mean, I was really.
Was it bad? And by the way, I never talked to women about this. You're the first woman I've ever really talked to about
honest?
This. On the air. It's not really what I do.
No, I know.
But because
I know.
Of the Catholicism.
I actually have been told that this is like not the area you like to go in.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone's been listening and advising
you. I've had several people be like, he doesn't want to go here. He wants to go here.
All right. So when did you, come out here? How old are you when you start, you want to be an actress?
I convinced my parents because, okay, first of all, this is really cliche, but my mom and dad decided to retire in California from Chicago because of the crappy winters. That's not the cliche, but because my dad was such a golf fanatic.
Right.
It was going to be somewhere where he could golf year round. So they wanted to go to San Diego because they had visited there once. And then I talked them into Los Angeles because I was so determined to be an actress of some kind that I knew I couldn't do it in San Diego. And so I had to look up golf courses. And when I say look up, it was like magazines,
right?
And be like, oh, are you kidding? The golf courses in near Fox Studios are great and near Warner Brothers.
Right.
They're the best golf
and
courses.
And you sold him on that?
Yeah, sold him. And we lived in the grossest apartment, sorry, but Pico and Lincoln.
How many kids were left in the house at that point?
At that point, it was just me. I mean, first of all, I was living with my parents until I was 28.
Mm.
So take that in. Well, but don't worry, because it got really normal when I moved in with the next door neighbor, John.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was living with him 3 feet away from my mom and dad's apartment. So when you
in a romantic relationship?
At Pico and Lincoln.
You romantic, met your neighbor?
Yes.
And that's who you decided to be with.
I moved next door. But what I mean is, you know, mom and dad would open the front door and there was John, my boyfriend, 3 feet away.
Uh-huh.
Did that for 5 years, off and on.
Come on.
Sorry.
What is that about?
It's true.
What were you afraid
of? It's about mental illness. I don't know what it's
kind
about.
Of mental
it's about
illness?
I mean, not mental. It's about something was wrong with me that I would think,
well, what
I'm
going
to segue to the boyfriend.
What do you think it was? What were you afraid of? Why didn't
you
leave?
Well, first of all, I think I liked him. But I don't think it occurred to me if I liked him to go, you know, John, you and I should probably
get a place further away.
Even down the block. I
where
mean,
they can
anything.
Hear us through the walls? They can't. But were you that attached to your parents? Is that the last kid syndrome?
Or will. It's the last kid syndrome. And also, my parents did this thing that was really fucked up where they really worked hard to indoctrinate me and convince me that there was no way I could financially support myself. And it's one of the reasons I am so money obsessed to this day, is because my mom saw the infamous like 60 Minutes about the lady who lost everything and had to eat in her car and live in her car and eat dog food. And so to this day, you could probably call my mother and she would say, if Kathleen doesn't stop spending,
she's going to eat dog food.
Right. But just so you know, I'm not a crazy spender. Like, I own my house outright. I own my car outright. I'm not walking around with an Hermes bag. But to this day, I still kind of
what
have
kind
that
of bag
voice.
Do you have?
All right, I have a Gucci bag. But it's 10 years old. But anyway, I'm just saying, you know, I really believed at that time that while I was temping full time and being in the Groundlings, I couldn't even afford an apartment. And so when I finally got my first studio apartment on Sentinella for $329 a month, I lived there for 6 years.
Yeah, very frugal and frayed.
I just thought, oh my gosh, $329 a month, and I'm working full time, and I'm in the Groundlings. How am I ever going to pay my rent? And so I was determined to never acquire any debt, which I never did. I borrowed once in my life. I borrowed $500 from a Groundling friend, lived in a panic until I paid him back like 3 weeks later, and that was it.
Who were now when you started the Groundlings? Who was in the crew?
Okay, this is impressive. So get ready.
What year is this?
This is, I'm gonna say, 78, 79.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm from Chicago, so right. I grew up worshiping Second City.
But you never went over there?
No, I went there constantly, but I was too young to be in the school.
So you actually went and watched?
all the time.
Who were the people there then?
Oh my gosh, it was Tim Kaczynski.
Kaczynski.
Yeah. It was Mary Gross. It was, you know, I'm probably some of the greats because my parents would take me there when I was a kid.
So it was a regular thing. So you were, it was it part of your life, second city.
First of all, that's one of the great things. One of the frustrating things about Los Angeles is, you know, it's the only major city I know of where people don't regularly go to live entertainment, theater of any kind. And so
they were a little jaded here.
To me, it's the hardest place to sell tickets in the world.
Yeah, because they can see you for nothing if they really want to.
Or they can go to a taping of a television show and see a celebrity or whatever. So anyway, we regularly went to Second City and we regularly went to see, you know, folk acts. Like I used to go see John Prine on Sundays, and he would actually perform at a club, but at a brunch.
With your parents?
Yeah.
So they were fans.
They were very good about that. Yeah. They were very good about like getting us out to like live entertainment and the arts and that sort of thing.
So you knew the comedic performing was something you were
especially Second
towards.
City.
Yeah.
So of course I worshipped comedy, and I can't believe I gave this up, but I used to have the playbill of the night that my mom and dad went to the Drury Lane Theater, which I believe was in the Round, and they went to see Woody Allen open for Jim Croce.
Really?
How cool is that? Like,
how that must have been in like just like he did stand up for like 69 to 72.
He opened for Jim Croce.
Wow. That must have been like in the 60s.
And my mom and dad, of course, went to see Woody Allen more, but they also thought Jim Croce was a good singer.
He was good.
So they had this kind of dichotomy where they were like these crazy Catholics, and then they would go see Woody Allen and Jim Croce. Okay, so Second City was my influence. And so I moved to Los Angeles, opened up the LA Weekly, which I lived by, and there was a bad review of The Groundlings, but it said it's similar in tone to Second City. So I went by myself. I took the number 4 bus. I went by myself. Honestly, maybe my second week in Los Angeles, was living in the apartment with my parents on Pico.
Late 70s?
79, I'm going to say. So it was before 80, maybe 80.
So it was before it really blew up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Way before. At that time, the most famous Groundlings were 3. It was Lorraine Newman, my idol.
Right.
It was Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, who was a very big local celebrity, obviously. And Pee Wee Herman had just mounted his show at the Roxy.
Okay.
Yet to be an HBO special.
Right.
So that's all I needed. So I went to the show by myself. I thought it was dazzling. I thought it was amazing. And I just wanted to do it so badly that I snuck backstage. I walked. And when I say backstage at the Groundlings, it's not exactly the Sydney Opera House. But it then became my home later. But anyway, I walked backstage, bold as brass, by myself. And I just went up to who I thought was the funniest person in the show. So I went to the backstage, and there was a guy standing there, and I just walked in, and he kind of looked surprised. And I said, I'm sorry to bother you, but I saw that I saw the show, and I just thought you guys were so incredible. How can I get involved in this? And he was so nice and so patient. And he said, well, there's a school, and there's a guy who runs the school, and I can introduce you to him, and there's a whole set of classes you have to go through.
Yeah.
And he was very patient. He spent a good 10 minutes with me. He directed me to the guy who ran the school, and that man's name was Phil Hartman.
Oh, really?
How about that?
So he probably wasn't there that long at that point either.
What was so awesome was he then, of course, left.
Yeah.
But he was a great mentor to me because prior to SNL, people don't know that Phil did every failed pilot in the world. And he really taught me that world of, and you and I know this world very well, when any one of our friends would get a pilot, we'd be like, oh, they're going to be big stars.
Right.
And then when the pilot doesn't go or the show gets canceled, and Phil Hartman was that guy. He was just constantly getting, he was on the precipice forever.
Yeah.
And he would leave the Groundlings.
Nice
and
guy, too, right?
Incredibly nice.
Yeah, I met him once.
Like, kind of a legit genius.
Yeah.
You know, people throw that word around, but really dazzling on stage.
He's a good artist, too.
A good artist.
He did album covers.
Well, the thing that I loved about him was he told me later that the way he ingratiated himself in the Groundlings, and I'm very big on ingratiation, is that he started, he went to the head of the school and said, can I do the graphics for, if I do the graphics for free, will you let me join the company? And that's how we got in the Groundlings.
Do they? So I wonder if those graphics still exist. Do they?
They're somewhere. I'm sure the Groundlings have them somewhere, but I remember seeing them in album covers. And he was a great artist, and he would be going to art shows when he wasn't performing, and that was certainly beyond my scope. But anyway, he then, of course, went to do pilots. But prior to SNL, he had one more run back at the Groundlings when I was finally in the Groundlings.
You auditioned for the classes, and then you got in.
Right.
You
went through the whole 4 years, was it? It was like 3 or 4 years, but I had one like 6-month period where Phil and I were actually in four shows a week together.
Wow.
And that was magical because he really was incredible.
And so that was once you got into the company. Who else was there?
My posse, I was there for so long. It took me so long to like get out of there. And I say that with all love and respect because all my friends passed me by. And it was really hard. I mean, everybody, John Lovitz was there for like 6 months and then got plucked for SNL. And, Lisa Kudrow and Julia Sweeney and I auditioned for Lorne Michaels on the same night. And then Julia got picked and then she was off to SNL land. And, everybody I started out with just was getting jobs and getting
working.
Jobs.
Were
no.
You weren't at all.
I was temping, honey. I was a Kelly girl.
Were you bitter?
Yes.
And angry.
It was hard. I mean, I loved these people, and then I just watched them all go on to bigger and better
things. Did you start
to
see yourself as somebody who was never going to be anything but a hobbyist?
Never. I never, and that's what infuriated my parents, is I never had the plan B. I was supposed to be a stew or a dental hygienist.
Right. And you never thought that.
Well, first of all, you're not supposed to say stew anymore. So let me stop you
there.
I'm
okay. I'm all right.
I didn't do that, much to their chagrin. And my parents actually paid for my grounding classes, which were like $385 a pop.
But you were getting angry.
Yes.
And brokenhearted.
Brokenhearted. I mean, first of all, Lorne Michaels in those days only came to the Groundlings like every 3 years. So the night that he came.
Yeah.
And then, he chose Julia Sweeney over Lisa Kudrow and myself. And then there were other girls backstage that were furious that the three of us were even in the running. So you're backstage with your friends and they're hating that you're in the running. And then, I didn't even get the job. So I'm like, okay, you can all go back to liking me for 5 seconds because guess what? I'm a failure again. Are we cool?
Yeah.
And it was always that, like, I was pulling for the other Groundling people, but it definitely hurt when they went on to like the great jobs, sitcom or SNL, whatever.
But you did a lot of TV work. I mean,
slow and steady. I mean, remember, my students were getting on SNL. So then
you were teaching at the Groundling?
That was my full-time job. And it's how I actually got my scratchy voice, is I would teach 5 days a week.
All right. So you quit temping.
And I quit temping.
You took a gig as a teacher at the Groundlings.
Yes. And I would do five classes a week for $100 a class.
You must have been out of your mind.
I was out of my mind. And then I would be doing the shows on Friday and Saturday. So I would be
just
doing...
to see all these young people come in and treat you like that. Like, you don't want to end up like her.
Sure. Well, no. Actually, it was the opposite. Uh-huh. It was like, Sherry O'Terry and Will Ferrell and Chris
Carnell. You taught
them? And they were like, oh my gosh, you're so great. You're my teacher.
You taught Will Ferrell?
Yes.
They were your students?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, the list goes on. List goes on. How about when I was a teacher and then later on I would audition for one of them because one of them would be the showrunner for Friends.
Oh my God.
But they were all very nice. I mean, it really wasn't like, I don't want to be like the sad lady. It was more like watching them go from, oh wow, you're my teacher. You're so funny. You're so great. I hope I get moved on to the next level, to like, maybe they don't say hi to me on the red carpet.
Right.
You know, when you lose a friend to, I call it the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, I don't know.
I know I've
other
had
business,
that happen. Yeah. Yeah.
So there are friends that are kind of like at your level, and then there are friends that are doing a little better, and then there are friends that are so famous that they can't return your call
for two years. What do you make of that psychologically? Being empathetic, what do you make of that?
Being empathetic, I actually really get it 90% of the time. In other words, the older I've gotten and the more people I've seen come and go up and down, the more I go, you know what? I actually get that in that maelstrom, you didn't have time to call me.
Yeah, it's busy.
It's busy, and it's something I can't understand, and I've never had that level of Lisa Kudrow at the height of Friends, Will Ferrell where he is now, etc. On the other hand, I also have now, as you have now come to know so many people that are so well known, that now I don't like cut them all slack.
Right.
Like I don't give them all the fame pass.
Right.
I give a lot of people the fame pass, and I don't know about you, but I definitely give them the pass for like the first couple years.
Well, it's weird because you don't really know where you stand in their lives legitimately. You know, you had this time with them together and you were struggling and this and that, but what's the friendship really built on? Because a lot of times when I think they enter that stratosphere, they end up with two people they can rely on. Sometimes they're old friends.
Yeah.
And sometimes, they don't want to be out in the world. They don't trust anybody anymore.
Yeah. And also, as you know, sometimes the two friends they're with are, of course, Dane Cook had the situation with his brother, which I think had to be devastating to him. Or, for me, I mean, I admit it, there's a long time where I was on the road so much and filming my life on the D-list and doing specials. I've done 20 specials that I hung out with my assistant Tiffany more than anybody in my life.
Because you don't have any time when you're self-employed and you have that momentum going. You don't even have fucking time to meet someone for coffee.
Well, you're also going city after city. Yeah. If there's a day where you're not in an airport, the last thing you want to do is like go to a bar and meet friends.
Well, see, what's fascinating to me about you, and after like, you know, doing the minor amount of research that I do, is that I don't know that I gave you credit for the amazing sort of persistence and accomplishment that you have. And have had done.
Well, I appreciate that very much because
you're off my radar a bit.
I know.
But you're definitely on other people's radar. You know, there's a lot of different radars now. And we all end up going different directions.
Well, that's what we struggle with.
But I mean, to me, when I first met you, and I remember when you did the bit part in Pulp Fiction and you were still running around being an actress. I mean, you did a lot of bit spots on TV shows. Is that at what point... Like, okay, so you're doing all comedy, you're bombing on stage,
yeah.
And you've decided to tell stories, you're doing Beth Lapidus's Room, you're trying different things.
Hot cup of talk.
Right, but you're trying everything.
Yeah.
You're doing everything
open
you can.
Open mic nights, anything.
Right.
Coffee houses, bookstores.
My recollection of you being angry is probably true. I mean, I picked that up.
Of course.
So some part of your will, you know, pushed you into this area where you sort of reinvented yourself, but I think you actually invented yourself. As Kathy Griffin, what we see now.
Yes.
And that all happened because of what?
Well, I'm just going to say it was 100% me, and I'll tell you why. Because one issue that I have with the level of bitterness that I have is one thing I've always craved desperately is I have never in my career had producerial support, network support, or agency support.
How about peer support?
Sometimes.
Because you were sort of
Let me tell you, early on, I had it in spades. And I have to say that I haven't talked to Groffel for a long time. I don't think she cares for me. But I will say that at that time, whether she likes it or not, the support I got from Margaret Cho, Janine Garofalo, Colin Quinn, Karen Kilgariff apparently doesn't like me now. But whether or not that's true, it meant everything to me that the late, great Judy Toll would say to me, keep doing your thing. Don't try to be a joke teller. That's not what you do.
Right.
Keep honing whatever it is you do. And certainly Beth Lapidus letting me go on stage pretty much every Sunday. And
she still will.
And the Groundlings saying, okay, you can have the Groundling Theater one night a week.
To work out your shit?
Yeah, no, to do a hot cup of talk.
Right, oh, okay.
Because I found this thing.
Was that a pilot idea?
No, there was a loophole in the Groundlings bylaws that if there was an empty night at the Groundling Theater and you were an active company member, you could have it for free. So, of course, I like read through the bylaws. I was looking for any kind of a venue because I was bombing at every club.
But that was a talk show, right?
No, it was stand-up. It was exactly like on Cabaret, and it was four comedians, and we actually had a timer.
Right.
And the show was $1 because I was so convinced that no one would pay more to see me and Janine Garofalo and Margaret Cho and Chicks. You know, and so we made the show $1. We made the show at the max an hour. So every comedian, four comedians, you put on the timer for 15 minutes. The whole audience could hear it ticking. When the bell went off, you introduced the next comic and everybody was gone in an hour. The reason I did that was, the industry showcase days. It was so hard to get industry people to come see me or the Groundlings, or I was never in that crowd where like... people were lining up with deals and contracts. So I would make it so easy for people to come see us that it was $1. And they knew that if they came at 8, they were out the door at 9. And so I did that for years.
Really? For years?
Years. I did on Cabaret and Hot Cup of Talk.
But you were still just acting.
I hadn't even gotten on my first sitcom, which was 1996. So we're talking like 1993, 1994, 1995.
So you're still beating your head against the wall.
Yes.
So now... The big break was the D-List show.
The big break was really Suddenly Susan, Here's Why. Because I was on an NBC show, arguably a horrible show.
Oh, that's right.
But a life-changing and really fun show. And I really, really loved everyone on the show. And, you know, it was not a good show. But it was a great job for me. So I bought my first house. And because of being on that show, I got my first HBO special. They took me to, I had to do a showcase at the Ice House. And I was like, the Ice House? And they said, the audiences there are notoriously nice. And they were right.
Yeah.
So Chris Albrecht, who then ran HBO, gave me my first special. And it was an hour.
Right.
My first special was the comedy special, half hours. And then I got an hour. And I said to him, so, you know, I'm obviously not that polished of a comedian. Why are you giving me an hour? And he said, because you're a girl and because you're on NBC Thursday night.
Uh-huh.
And I went, okay, good enough for me. That's fine with me. Whatever it takes to get in the door. Thank you.
But oddly, it's very weird because as a guy that came out of the club comedy scene and then, you know, was part of the alternative thing,
yeah,
is that the judgment of alternative comedy was always exactly what you were doing. Like they don't have jokes. They talk. They don't.
Improvisational. You know. Try not to do the same set twice.
But the weird thing is that I think it seems to me that you, out of all of them, because even Cho and Garofalo were club comedians.
They had the choice. Just so you know, I couldn't get booked at a club.
Right, okay.
So they were able to, and Dana Gould also, like he would do both worlds.
Right. But they came up in that. I mean, Dana definitely came up in it. But you, through persistence, you were one of the first ones to really sort of start to build a genuine audience.
Well, I started my own show, like Mickey freaking Rooney, because while Beth Lapidus was giving me stage time, which was amazing, I went, you know, the rest of the nights of the week, these other people can go and do other venues. And then that's when Jeanine Garofalo, Judy Tola, and I got together. And then I said, I think I can get the Groundlings one night a week. And we worked on, like, I think Judy did a flyer from, you know, a Kinko's.
Right.
And that's how we started Hot Cup of Talk. So at least it gave me two nights a week where I could do 15. So I would do on Cabaret as much as Beth and her husband Greg would let me.
Right.
And then I could do Hot Cup of Talk where it was my show. So it was me and three other people. I only had to book three other people. The Groundlings was a well-known place.
Yeah.
And then I consciously chose people that weren't comedians to join us. Like one night, Lisa Kudrow did 15 minutes and she's never done stand-up. One night, Quentin Tarantino did 15 minutes and he's obviously never done stand-up.
Are you still friends with him?
I don't see him a lot, but once again, I think of him as early on like a champion of mine. And someone who was like, there's something about this girl I like.
And but ultimately, you didn't go that direction.
No, I really love what I do more than anything.
But how did the My Life on the D-List happen?
Oh, because I was supposed to have a very expensive, fancy Seinfeld-esque four-camera sitcom,
mm-hmm.
and then the bottom fell out. So what happened was, After Hot Cup of Talk, I then got on Suddenly Susan for 4 years. When that ended, I was told by everybody, like, you're going to get your own show. I had meetings with everybody. Then none of it happened. So I had a year of sleeping till 1 o'clock, watching Oprah.
Depressed, bitter,
ice cream and Oprah. And thinking, what the fuck am I going to do? What the fuck? Everybody said I was going to be hooked up. My next show was just right around the corner. Nothing. Crickets.
Why do you think that was?
It was everything from people thought I couldn't drive a show or be a co-star of a show. I remember one time in a meeting with an executive, him saying, you know, we'd love to pair you with somebody, another girl who's really, really funny, like a Carmen Electra. Now, I like Carmen Electra. She's a nice girl.
Right.
She did my talk show.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, when they said that, I thought they were going to say, you and Jeanine Garofalo are going to have a buddy cop show or something.
Sure.
I'm just saying. So I would have meetings when they wanted
you to be the brassy sidekick.
But they would say things like, we want to put you with another comedian like Lara Flynn Boyle.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm sitting there going, like, I love Twin Peaks. I wouldn't say Lara Flynn Boyle is a comedian, you know. So it just never happened because they didn't quite know what to do with me. And then
You got money at this point?
I got enough money where I can think about it a little bit. But I have no, the agencies are like, fuck her. Nobody wants a...
Yeah, and when they cut you loose, you're done.
Oh, I was done. Yeah. I was so done. So then I came up with an idea. I called my stand-up agent, who I've been with since like 1994, who's a good dude, Steve Levine at ICM. And I called him up and I said, what is the worst time slot at the Laugh Factory? And he said, why? And I said, well, I've never had a good set at the Store or the Improv, but I've never really played the Laugh Factory.
Right.
And he said, I don't know, Wednesdays at 10 p.m. So I said, will you call Jamie Masada and ask if I can have Wednesdays at 10 p.m. and he can take the door and the drinks and I'll do it for free? And he said, I guess so. And I had to sell them on that.
Right.
So I had to then talk to Jamie and say, what's your top? He said, okay, Wednesday's at 10. It's hard to get people to come in.
Right.
I said, I'll take it. So.
Were you just trying to beat yourself up?
No, I wanted anywhere where I could stand on stage and do what I do. And so being a promotional machine, I already was able to get on like some talk shows because of being on an NBC show. But I was also literally with my former assistant, Jessica, standing at Hollywood and Highland, handing out flyers and saying, hi, it's me, Kathy Griffin from television. Would you like to come see me do stand up? And then that's really what turned things around for me is I started doing, I would pick a month. a month that had five. So if there was a month that had five Mondays,
five Wednesdays.
But maybe the next month would have five Tuesdays.
Right.
So I would do 5 weeks in a row at the Laugh Factory. And then luckily it got some traction. And within about 3 weeks, there was a line around the block. And then, as you
know.
And
how did your act change, though? Is that when
every
you cut
week was
loose?
Different.
But did you tonally change? Take no prisoners, no holds barred?
Yes.
Did you do something different? Were you like, fuck it? It's all
Fuck
coming
it.
Out
no,
now.
Who cares? I'm at a little comedy club. This is before
and you're
people
at the end of your rope.
Taping things with their cell phones.
Right.
I would actually open the show with a tape I had, a VHS tape that I operated myself from the upstairs at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
And I would pause it and make funny comments. So
right.
My opener was I would show a tape from Mariah Carey on Cribs.
Yeah.
Being crazy.
Yeah.
So the tape, you know, the audience would laugh because they see Mariah Carey and they know it's funny. And,
yeah.
And then I would pause it and I would make a comment. So
right.
They would hear my voice.
Right.
Then I would do that for maybe 5 minutes. And then I would do my own intro, ladies and gentlemen, and try to make it funny. You
yeah.
know her as Maxim's top 100 hot girls, bikini model, Kathy Griffin.
Sure.
Run downstairs, and I was always supposed to do an hour, and I always did 2 hours. So every week I would do a new 2 hours.
Did you think that at that time was your tone different? Was it the tone of somebody who'd had it with show business on some level?
The tone was getting more showbiz oriented. For example, like when I was doing Hot Cup of Talk,
right.
Prior to being a regular on a television show, my act was more about, I'd say, kind of family and guys I was banging and stuff like that. But as I started working in Hollywood for real, that's when the whole like telling tales out of school, talking smack about celebrities,
right.
being honest about who was really naughty and nice during the commercial breaks, that's really how that started.
Right.
Once I started working with Brooke Shields,
yeah,
I mean, I couldn't keep that stuff out of my act.
Right.
She was dating and married to Andre Agassi, and we were going on his jet to his house in Vegas. And then, of course, I thought his behavior was odd. And so later when he released his book, Close, I believe it's called,
yeah.
he confessed that he was doing crystal meth during that period. And so I would be going on stage going, you know, I went to Andre Agassi's house this weekend and he sure is energetic. Like, I didn't even know. And so then Brooke would be mad at me and she'd say, you can't talk about Andre in your act. And I'd say, I'll try not to. And then I'd hit the stage and I couldn't help myself because it was insane to me to see Andre Agassi on crystal meth.
Well, what
How can you keep that out of your act?
And this is when you were doing the Laugh Factory.
Yes.
So.
And I started doing more specials then.
Right. Well,
so
I just started doing specials. You turned out specials every year, it seems like.
I did 20 specials. I was
HBO and the rest, and how many for?
Well, I did two for HBO that they then sold to Comedy Central. And then after that, I did them for Bravo and now I own them. And so they're kind of like everywhere. Like some of them you can buy. Some of them you just will see on reruns on Comedy Central.
And you did four Comedy Records.
I did. No, gosh. I have six Grammy nominations. So
right.
I did at least six. I finally won this year for Best Comedy Album.
Congratulations.
The first woman to win since 1986.
That's
I just want to
say.
But as far as albums, I actually don't know the number because
they make the specials albums.
And then you add material.
Right.
So the kind of fun thing about the albums is it really is the stuff that is too horrible even for Bravo.
Right.
Is my pride talking point.
Now, two questions. Now, when did you start sort of kind of embracing, how does one become camp?
Yeah.
Because there's only a few of you.
Yeah.
And how does one embrace that? When did you become shameless about plastic surgery, about, you know, being outspoken, even if they are peers of yours?
Right.
I mean, what is the appeal to the gay and lesbian community? How does that happen?
Well, I think, first of all, one thing is when I was doing open mic nights, it certainly wasn't limited to comedy open mic nights.
Right.
So when you're me and you have no skills and you just want to try to be funny, you don't know how, you know, I mean, I think I did the infamous waiting in line at the Improv like twice.
Right.
And I went, okay, this is not working. And so I would open up the LA Weekly and I would see gay clubs that had open mic nights. I would go to a jazz club that had an open mic night because they would let a comedian do one set. So I was dragging my parents to all of these. So while I'm bitching and joking about them, they would either, you know, drive me because we all shared one Toyota Corolla, or they would try and come and laugh and be supportive. And that part of it is like very touching.
Yeah.
And then once I finally hooked up with you guys and kind of our crowd,
right.
I thought, well, at least I have people to kind of sit with at the coffee house. Or, you know, I would go watch Janine, you know, do every set, or I would just ride with Margaret Cho on the way to a club. Judy Toll would just take me to the Comedy Store and I would just watch from the back and just be happy to be in the car with her.
Right.
So I was, but I always looked at you guys like, God, I just don't think I can do that. You know, I mean, I can't write a joke to this day. I cannot write a setup and punchline joke to this day. It's a story with jokes weaved in.
Sure.
But I really love all styles. So I really enjoyed watching Judy Toll in the Growlings with me, then go do a set at the store. And then I enjoyed Margaret Cho. I remember watching her headline one time at Caroline's, and I had never seen her do a club. I had only seen her do alt clubs.
Yeah.
So I was dazzled at how she was able to translate the kind of improvisational, tangential style of the alt clubs. And then all of a sudden she was headlining at Caroline's. And then because of being on an NBC show, I then started headlining at clubs. So I just want you to know, I went from bombing at coffee houses to then clubs calling and saying, oh, this girl is now getting...
So we maybe make some money.
Right.
Yeah. But how do you, like, when did you ever see yourself early on as being this character of you that you are now? I mean, at what point do you start?
Do you mean like how did the gays and I find each other?
Well, kind of. But I mean, also, I think it has something to do with shamelessness.
Yes.
And it doesn't sound like that was always part of your story.
No, I think when you come from a family that is all about either being shame-based or thinking they should be ashamed of something that, frankly, they shouldn't even be ashamed about, I think that then, you know, the typical cliche story, it makes you want to go completely the opposite. And so...
But it took you a while to do that.
Yeah, but I did it early on. Like, I don't know if you remember this, but when I got liposuction in, like, 1998, I used to show slides of the post-lipo, and it was, people would just be practically vomiting, because I really thought, like, this is very authentic, this is so horrible and gross, it's funny, and granted, my bar for things being funny is too high, for gross things being funny,
right.
But I mean, that's what I thought was sort of, I don't want to say the norm, but I thought, well, if I had liposuction, I'm not going to lie about it, you know, so I can't just act like I had the flu for 2 weeks.
Do you think that any of this transparency or any of this aggressive exposure of your own self was a liability to you? I mean, you know, before you became what you are, did you ever think that people were like, nah, I don't want to, she's a little much?
I think obviously certain people just went, she's a little much. And then the good news is the people that were in were all in. And then that's what led to my life on the D-list.
But that's really
what was the game changer for me.
Right. But once you got the opportunity to do exactly what you wanted to do,
yeah,
more people got all in.
Yes.
And the gay community was extremely supportive from the beginning?
Well, I think because the show was so populated with gay people anyway,
yeah,
it's you know, I mean, I don't even know if I can articulate it. I mean, the gay culture and I are so intertwined and have been since I was like a little kid that it was never a conscious thing to have like gay people on my reality show or for me to be, you know, the D-list would follow me as I hosted the Gay Porn Awards. That's shit I was doing off camera.
Right.
So the thing about my life on the D-list is the thing I'm really the most proud of is, unlike today's quasi-reality shows, that really was a show where for 6 years, they followed me around for 6 months a year hoping I would say something funny.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't manufacture situations. I would have an offer come across my desk like, do you want to host the Gay Porn Awards? And then maybe in my real life, frankly, maybe I would have been like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I would have been thinking, well, we have filming coming up. This is a genuine offer that came through. Let's put it on the show. So stuff like that. You know, I performed on a gay cruise. I performed on a gay flight all the way to New Zealand. You know, those were job offers that came to me off season.
Right.
I would just say, you know, if it's during season, yes, that'll be a funny episode. If it's off season, I'd be like, hey, guess what? Is there any way we can hold off on this and then we'll make it part of my life on the D-list?
Right.
But I mean, the same thing was happening off camera as on camera. And I would say to Bravo every year that they didn't pick up my show because they would make me wait until the very last second. I would always say to them, you know, I'm going to do this show with or without cameras.
Right.
So either you can document my life on the D-list or I'm just going to keep living my life on the D-list.
And you won 2 Emmys.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Incredible. It's incredible. And let me just say this. They're hard to win.
Yeah.
They're really hard. So I get bitter about assholes that leave the Emmys early or lose them.
Yeah.
Or say my kid broke them or I left them in the bathroom or I'm not sure where they are.
Uh-huh.
They're fucking hard to win. They're hard. Okay. A Grammy's very hard to win. I had 5 years of losing in a row. No one's even been nominated 6 years in a row before me. So every year I lost, I was pissed.
Well, it must feel amazingly gratifying to have defined yourself on your own terms. And then the world was like, okay, we'll take her.
Right. They kind of had to. Eventually, they just sort of had to.
No matter whoever, no matter whatever peers you might have had or what other,
yes.
whatever comics are going like, fuck her.
I wasn't going away.
Yeah.
That's right. It was like my good friend Cher, also very in the LGBT community. You know, Cher famously said, you know, after the Holocaust, there's going to be Cher and cockroaches. And I put me right in there. Share cockroaches and
so
me.
It's that shamelessness and that persistence and that
I don't have a choice. I love how you're acting like I have a choice. There's no one has ever been a Lorne Michaels. There's never been a network that said, oh, we're going to court you. No one's courted me.
My success came in my garage. Believe me,
yes.
I get it.
Yes.
I'm 50.
Yes.
And it happened four years ago.
But that's why I love you. It's years and years and years of doing it and doing it and doing it.
Because I didn't see any other choice.
No.
There was no other choice.
No.
I didn't know how it was going to go down.
But what was it like for you watching the bros? I call straight guys bros.
Well, the problem with me was that either you're going to let bitterness define you, which is not appealing.
Mm-hmm.
That at some point you have to, you know, you have to give in to the humbling to find where you're going to go next. You can't just, you know, expect to be angry and entitled,
mm-hmm.
and you can't function from that place. I mean, at some point, you must have felt like, I'm fucked.
Well, my whole thing was to laugh at it the whole time. I mean, hence calling the show My Life on the D-List.
Right, but there wasn't a moment there before that where you're like, it's over.
No, because it was always, and look, I'm there
just
right
kind of
now.
Around.
It was
yeah.
it was like, once again, you know, like we'll talk about late night, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I've literally heard the phrases in the last month. A, we're not considering any females for that position. B, you're not part of the conversation. I've mm-hmm. heard those two in meetings in the last month. So when you can, you know, I'm so used to hearing, you know, the chick thing and the, you're not part of the conversation that I just have to figure out a way to insert myself into the conversation.
Is this something you want to do?
Yes, I would love. You know what I would love to do? Would love to bring back a show like the old Tom Snyder show. Remember,
yeah,
he
smoked
the cigarette and he was bitter and rant.
I'm hung up on that. That's what I do in here.
I'm hung up on Costas, the old Bob Costas, with his encyclopedic memory.
Yeah.
I love the idea of just the art of conversation.
Sure.
And I feel like what the next big thing is, and this is me standing alone, but you know,
I think I might be there with you.
I feel that the next big thing that's going to be cool and trendy is as simple as a return to legitimacy. Because I feel like, as much as I love to make fun of the Housewives and the Kardashians, I really feel that collectively, even people.
Authenticity.
There's something about just watching people who know what they're doing do their thing.
No, absolutely. I'm completely on board with that.
But it's hard to sell. Because it's so pared down and simple.
Well, they don't trust it.
Nobody will buy. That's right.
They don't trust it. They're
that's
like,
right.
I don't wear the bells and whistles.
That's right.
Right. They don't.
That's right.
I know.
I've also had people like Phil Rosenthal say, I'm going to tell you a dirty secret that no network head will ever tell you. So I'm thinking Phil Rosenthal. He's
sure.
made a mint from Everybody Loves Raymond.
Right.
I think Ray Romano is hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm going to really listen. He says what none of these network people will tell you is that a female-driven comedy is not going to sell in syndication. And I took that in and I said, you mean like I Love Lucy?
Or Roseanne.
Or Grace Under Fire.
Grace
or Murphy
Under Fire.
Brown. Yeah. That's right. And so.
Don't listen to him.
But I'm just saying, these things happen to this day. And so you're right. I don't get bitter and scream at these people. You know, Ben Silverman said to me one time about 30 Rock. He kept saying, it's Alec's show. It's Alec's show. And this and this and Alec. And finally, and I don't even know Tina Fey that well. And I certainly never had Lorne Michaels doing my heavy lifting. That's
right.
for sure.
Right.
I wish.
Yeah.
But anyway, I said to him, you know, as a joke, I said, I mean, I just so you know, as a viewer, I would consider that to be Tina's show. I mean, it's sort of obviously based on her life and her experience, but I think Alec is brilliant in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he denies that he said that. But I'm just saying, I think that rolls off the tongue of people so easily that I, like you, am very much in the habit of, I'm not coming in the front door.
Right.
So I'm looking for the window and the side door.
Yeah.
And I'm right there again today, trying to figure it out. Side door, how do I get it going?
Sure. Or I'll just be outside in my truck honking.
But here's what I'm not buying. Are you buying... Or have you let go of the idea? I'm sure you've had all these meetings in the last 10 years that it's all about YouTube. It's all
about
the web show.
No, I never bought any.
Okay, thank you. Back me up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It will always seem, well, you get to a point where it's like you realize during those conversations that they need me more than I need them.
And they're not putting any money up front.
They did a little, but
any revenue,
not Kathy Griffin money.
Well, what I'm saying is, look, I think Funny or Die is great, but the last time I checked, it seems like Will Ferrell and Adam McKay make all the money from Funny or Die.
Well, yeah, I just don't know.
It's kind of just like a network.
I think people are watching TV like that, but they're watching TV from TV like that. It's still fairly difficult to get people to do, watch stuff that is innately on the web.
Yeah.
You know, other than cat videos or things that people send them.
And also the dirty little secret that I don't know why this should be on the cover to me of Deadline or Reporter or whatever every single day, which is TV is still the most watched medium.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It doesn't, like, it's great that the guy who does the history of dance gets all those views. But as far as just pound for pound viewers, television is still the most watched medium.
They sit down in their living room and they do it. So let me ask you this. How do you feel about yourself now?
Like, in what way?
Always.
Like, professionally, personally?
Well, I mean, your personal life, is that a struggle?
I
know you got a new guy. I know you've been through some shit.
I've been through some shit. I mean, I am pretty angst ridden. I call it the hamster wheel. I have a lot of trouble sleeping. I'm constantly writing in my head, which I enjoy. I have a stand-up comedy disorder. I can't stop doing stand-up. I love it. I don't care if it's Carnegie Hall or a Racino.
Right. But do you...
Can I just stop you?
What?
You have no reaction to me saying I played a Racino?
What is that?
Thank you. You don't even know what it is. I played one 2 weeks ago. No. It's a combination casino and...
Racetrack?
Yes.
Did you do all right?
Yeah, I did all right. I probably actually got paid more than Carnegie. But the point is, I love doing stand-up so much that, like, when my friends give me shit about, like, what are you doing playing a Racino? It's like it didn't even occur to me to go, oh, that's right. I go with whatever is the market value. So I... Oh, God, I'm going to quote Jay Leno, and I know alternative comics hate him, but he said something very helpful to me, which is he said, you know, he does all the stand-up, and as you know, he doesn't spend the stand... He's never touched the Tonight Show money.
Yeah.
Okay, but he said that he went to his buyers at one point after 2008 and said, look, you guys have been good to me all these years. Pay me whatever you can pay me now. And I was like, wow, that's baller, like when you can just say that. So you know, I don't want to say I'll work for nothing, but I'm not crazy. I'm not, you know, I only have to have the private jet and I only take $100,000 a show. Like, I'm not Kevin Hart,
right?
You know.
But do you, like...
And I don't even know Kevin Hart. I'm just assuming he gets insane money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're definitely operating at that level. You're at a high pay point. But I mean, do you feel... You don't feel like you're done in any way. You don't feel like...
Oh, no.
Are you happy?
I'm gonna get a talk show.
I know that...
You watch.
Like, is someone like Chelsea Handler a nemesis of yours?
Not at all. But I am almost amused by how a woman so successful is like, whatever she's feeling with that job, like bored with it or done with it, or, you know, what she say, it's a sad, sad place to live on that network. I'm just, you know, okay. So I hope you're dazzled by this. So 2 weeks ago, I had dinner with, wait for it, Maury Povich.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
I worship him.
Okay.
I worship the Secretly Loaded. Here's why. I've met Maury Povich. I've met Jerry Springer. I've had dinner with Judy Scheinlin. I am fascinated by people that are what I call secret ballers. So I'm fascinated by what makes them tick and how they roll and why they work that way. And I had someone else, I guess I shouldn't say the person's name, but someone else who's a secret baller who's beyond loaded. And she said to me, I was reading those stupid Forbes lists. And I called her, and as a joke, I said, I know you have more money than all these people. And she said, why would I want to be on the Forbes list?
Yeah.
What do I want my kids to get kidnapped? I don't want to be on the Forbes list.
Right.
So I thought that was funny that she's so loaded that she thinks an idiot would want to be on the Forbes list. So anyway, I said to Maury Povich, and I went to two tapings of the show, which of course was hilarious, and it's all theater. But I said, are you having as much fun as it looks like you are? And he said, I really am. And he's 75. And I said, why? Why are you having... I mean, tell me the secret. And he said, because I'm old. And I just totally got that. And so when you asked me about Chelsea, I am friends with Chelsea. I respect her tremendously. I think she's hilarious. I'm just saying that at 53, I think that you have a different attitude about having a talk show and having great success.
So you're telling me you know how to have fun.
I'm telling you that I'm old enough to, if I had a talk show, I would be pretty freaking happy. And when I had my talk show on Bravo and when I had my life on the D-list, I was frazzled, but I was real happy to be making people laugh.
Work.
Love it.
Well, I enjoy talking to you.
My pleasure.
Do you feel good about it?
Absolutely.
Okay, Kathy. Okay, that's it. That's our show. As per usual, go to WTFpod.com for all you WTF Pod needs. Get the app if you don't have the app. Check the calendar at WTF Pod. If you want to know where I'm going, if you want links to any of that stuff, leave a comment if you have a Facebook page, which is how we do it now. But you can do it right on the site. What else? Oh, let's celebrate life. Boomer lives!